That looks like it would have a really hard time killing me.
What do you weigh, Gus? 3 beer cans, some bones, and a cigarette?
And all the hard lines and lean ridges of muscle I definitely hadn't gawked at.
Any number of those painted animals could kill you with a sneeze.
Wow, he said. First of all, I may only weigh 3 beer cans, but that's still 3 more beer cans than your ex-boyfriend. He looked like he did nothing but chew wheatgrass while running. I weigh easily twice what he did. Secondly, you're one to talk. You're what, 4 feet and 6 inches?
I'm a very tall 5'4", actually, I said. He narrowed his eyes and shook his head at me.
You're as small as you are ridiculous.
So, not very?
Carousel, final offer, Gus said.
This is the perfect place for our montage, I said.
Our what now?
Young, extremely beautiful, and very tall for her height, woman in sparkly tennis shoes teaches fearful, party-hating curmudgeon how to enjoy life, I said. There'd be a lot of head shaking, a lot of me dragging you from ride to ride, you dragging me back out of the line, me dragging you back into it. It'd be adorable, and more importantly, it'll help with your super romantic suicide cult book. It's the promise of the premise portion of the novel, when your readers are grinning ear to ear. We need a montage.
Gus folded his arms and studied me with narrowed eyes. Come on, Gus. I bumped his arm.
You can do it. Be adorable.
His eyes darted to where I'd bumped him, then back to my face, and he scowled.
I think you misunderstood me. I said adorable.
His surly expression cracked. Fine, January. But it's not going to be a montage. Choose one death trap. If I survive that, you can sleep well tonight knowing you brought me one step closer to believing in happy endings.
Oh my God, I said. If you wrote this scene, would we die?
If I wrote this scene, it wouldn't be about us.
Wow. One, I'm offended. Two, who would it be about?
He scanned the crowd and I followed his gaze. Her, he said finally.
Who?
He stepped in close behind me, his head hovering over my right shoulder. There, at the bottom of the Ferris wheel.
The girl in the screw me, I'm Irish shirt, I said.
His laugh was warm and rough in my ear. Standing this close to him was bringing back flashes of the night at the frat house I'd rather not revisit. The woman working the machine, he said in my ear. Maybe she'd make a mistake and watch someone get hurt because of it. This job was probably her last chance, the only place that would hire her after she made an even bigger mistake. In a factory, maybe. Or she broke the law to protect someone she cared about. Some kind of almost innocent mistake that could lead to less innocent ones.
I spun to face him. Or maybe she'd get a chance to be a hero. This job was her last chance, but she loves it, and she's good at it. She gets to travel, and even if she mostly only sees parking lots, she gets to meet people. And she's a people person. The mistake isn't hers. The machinery malfunctions, but she makes a snap decision and saves a girl's life. That girl grows up to be a congresswoman or a heart surgeon. The two of them cross paths again down the road. The Ferris wheel operator's too old to travel with the carnival anymore. She's been living alone, feeling like she wasted her life. Then one day, she's alone. She has a heart attack. She almost dies, but she manages to call 911. The ambulance rushes her in, and who is her doctor but that same little girl? Of course, Ferris doesn't recognize her. She's all grown up. But the doctor never could have forgotten Ferris's face. The two women strike up a friendship. Ferris still doesn't get to travel, but twice a month, the doctor comes over to Ferris's double wide and they watch movies. Movies set in different countries. They watch Casablanca and eat Moroccan takeout. They watch The King and I and eat Siamese food, whatever that may be. They even watch, gasp, Bridget Jones's Diary while binging on fish and chips. They make it through 20 countries before Ferris passes away. And when she does, Doctor realizes her life was a gift she almost didn't get. She takes some of Ferris's ashes, her ungrateful asshole son didn't come to collect them, and sets out on a trip around the world. She's grateful to be alive. The end. Gus stared at me. Only one corner of his very crooked mouth at all engaged. I was fairly sure he was smiling, although the deep grooves between his eyebrows seemed to disagree.
"Then write it," he said finally.
"Maybe so," I said. He glanced back at the gray-haired woman working the machinery.
"That one," he said. "I'm willing to ride that one, but only because I trust Ferris so damn much."
Chapter 12. The Olive Garden. There was no montage. It was a slow night on the warm asphalt, under the neon glow and screeching metal of cheap rides. Hours of eating deep-fried food and drinking lime-infused beer from sticky cans between visits to each of the 7 rides. There was no dragging in and out of lines. There was just wandering, telling stories. Gus pointed at a pregnant girl with a barbed wire tattoo.
"She joins the cult."
"She does not," I disagreed.
"She does. She loses the baby. It's awful. The only thing that starts to bring her back to life is this rising YouTube star she follows. She finds out about New Eden from him, then goes for a weekend-long seminar and never leaves."
"She's there for 2 years," I countered. "But then her little brother comes to get her. She doesn't want to see him, and security's trying to get him out of there, but then he pulls out a sonogram. His girlfriend, May, is pregnant. A little boy, due in a month. She doesn't leave with him, but that night..."
"She tries to leave." Gus took over. "They won't let her. They lock her in a white room to decontaminate her. Her exposure to her brother's energy, they say, has temporarily altered her brain chemistry. She has to complete the 5 purification steps. If she still wants to leave after that, they'll let her."
"She completes them," I said. "The reader thinks they've lost her, that she's stuck. But the last line of the book is some clue, something she and her brother used to say, some sign that she kept a secret part of herself safe, and the only reason she's not leaving yet is because there are people trapped there she wants to help." We went back and forth like that all night, and when we finally stopped, it was only because writing The Scrambler left me so nauseated, I ran from it to the nearest trash can and vomited heartily. Even as the recently eaten chili dog was rushing back up, I had to think the night had been some kind of success. After all, Gus grabbed my hair and pulled it away from my face as I retched. At least until he grumbled,
"Shit, I hate vomit,"
and ran off gagging. Hate, I found out on the ride home, was a less embarrassing way to say fear. National Book Award nominee Augustus Everett was vomit-phobic and had been ever since a girl named Ashley in his 4th grade class puked on the back of his head.
"I haven't puked in easily 15 years, he told me, "and I've had the stomach flu twice in that time."
I was fighting giggles as I drove. In general, I didn't find phobias funny, but Gus was a former gravedigger turned suicide cult investigator. Nothing Grace said in our interview had made him bat an eye, and yet cheap rides and puke had nearly bested him. "God, I'm sorry," I said, regaining control of myself. I glanced over to him, slumped back in my passenger seat with one arm folded behind his head. "I can't believe my first lesson in love stories actually just unearthed multiple traumas for you. At least you didn't end up also, you know, whatting." I didn't say the word, just in case. His eyes flashed over to me, and the corner of his mouth curled.
"Trust me, I got out in the nick of time. One more second, and you would have gotten Ashley Phillips'd."
"Wow," I said. "And yet you held my hair. So noble, so brave, so selfless." I was teasing, but it actually was pretty sweet.
"Yeah, well, if you didn't have such nice hair, I wouldn't have bothered."
Gus's eyes went back to the road.
"But I learned my lesson. Never again will I try to be a hero."
"My parents met at a carnival." I hadn't meant to say it. It had just slipped out. Gus looked at me, his expression inscrutable.
"Yeah?"
I nodded. I fully intended to drop the subject, but the last few days had loosened something in me, and the words came pouring out. "Their freshman year at Ohio State."
"Oh, not the Ohio State University," he teased.
Michiganders and Ohioans had a major rivalry I often forgot about due to my total ignorance of sports.
Dad's brothers had lovingly referred to him as the Great Defector, and he'd teased me with the same nickname when I chose U of M. "Yes, the very one," I played along. We fell into silence for a few seconds.
"So?" Gus prompted. "Tell me about it."
"No," I said, giving him a suspicious smile. "You don't want to hear that."
"I'm legally obligated to," he said. "How else am I going to learn about love?"
An ache speared through my chest. Maybe not from them. He cheated on her. A lot. While she had cancer.
"Damn," Gus said. "That's shitty,"
says the man who doesn't believe in dating. He ran a hand through his already messy hair, leaving it ravaged. His eyes flickered to me, then back to the road.
"Fidelity was never my issue."
"Fidelity across a 2-week span isn't exactly impressive," I pointed out.
"I'll have you know, I dated Tessa Armstrong for a month," he said.
"Monogamously? Because I seem to remember a sordid night in a frat house that would suggest otherwise." Surprise splashed across his face.
"I'd broken up with her when that happened."
"I saw you with her that morning," I said. It probably should have been embarrassing to admit I remembered all this, but Gus didn't seem to notice that. In fact, he just seemed a little insulted by the observation. He mussed his hair again and said irritably,
"I broke up with her at the party."
"She wasn't at the party," I said.
"No, but since it wasn't the 17th century, I had a phone."
"You called from a party and dumped your girlfriend?" I cried. "Why would you do that?" He looked my way, eyes narrowed.
"Why do you think, January?"
I was grateful for the dark. My face was suddenly on fire. My stomach felt like molten lava was pouring down it. Was I misunderstanding? Should I ask? Did it matter? That was almost a decade ago, and even if things had gone differently that night, it wouldn't have amounted to anything in the long run. Still, I was burning up. "Well, shit," I said. I couldn't get anything else out. He laughed.
"Anyway, your parents," he said. "It couldn't have been all bad."
I cleared my throat. It could not have sounded any less natural. I might as well have just screamed, "I don't want to talk about my sad parents while I'm thinking fiery thoughts about you," and gotten it over with. "It wasn't," I said, focusing on the road. "I don't think."
"And the night they met?" he pressed.
Again, the words came gushing out of me, like I'd needed to say them all year, or maybe they were just a welcome diversion from the other conversation we'd been having. "They went to this carnival at a local Catholic church," I said. "Not together, like they went separately to the same carnival, and then they ended up standing in line next to each other for that Esmeralda thing. You know, the animatronic psychic in a box."
"Oh, I know her well," Gus said. "She was one of my first crushes."
There was no reason that should have sent new fireworks of heat across my cheeks, and yet, here we were. "So anyway," I went on, "my mom was the fifth wheel on this, like, blatant double date trying to disguise itself as a casual hang. So when the others went off to go through the Tunnel o' Love, she went to get her fortune. My dad said he left his group when he spotted this beautiful red-haired girl in a blue polka dot dress."
"Betty Crocker?"
Gus guessed. "She's a brunette. Get your eyes checked," I said. A smile quirked Gus's lips.
"Sorry for interrupting. Go on. Your dad's just spotted your mom."
I nodded. "Anyway, he spent the whole time he was in line trying to figure out how to strike up a conversation with her. And finally, when she paid for her prediction, she started cussing like a sailor." Gus laughed.
"I love seeing where you get your admirable qualities from."
I flipped him off and went on. "Her prediction had gotten stuck halfway out of the machine, so Dad steps up to save the day. He manages to rip the top half of the ticket out, but the rest is still stuck in the machine, so Mom can't make sense of the words. So then he told her she'd better stick around and see if her fortune came out with his."
"Oh, that old line," Gus said, grinning.
"Works every time," I agreed. "Anyway, he put in his nickel and the two tickets came out. Hers said, 'You will meet a handsome stranger,
and his said, "Your story's about to begin." They still had them framed in the living room, or at least when I was home for Christmas, they were still up. That deep ache passed through me. It felt like a metal cheese slicer pulled right through my center, left there midway through my body. I'd thought missing my dad would be the hardest thing I'd ever do, but the worst thing, the hardest thing, had turned out to be angry with someone you couldn't fight it out with. Someone you loved enough that you desperately wanted to push through the shit and find a way to make a new normal. I would never get a real explanation from Dad. Mom would never get an apology. We'd never be able to see things from his point of view or actively choose not to. He was gone, and everything of him we'd planned to hold on to was obliterated. They were married 3 months later, I told Gus. Some 25 years after that, their only daughter's first book, Kiss Kiss Wish Wish, came out with Sandy Low Books, with a dedication that read, "To my parents," Gus said, "who are proof of fate's strong, if animatronic, hand." My mouth fell open. I'd almost forgotten what he had told me at the gas station, that he'd read my books. Or maybe I hadn't let myself think about it, because I was worried that meant he'd hated them, and somehow I was still competing with him, needing him to recognize me as his rival and equal. "You remember that?" It came out as a whisper. His eyes leapt toward me, and my heart rose in my throat.
"It's why I asked about them," he said. "I thought it was the nicest dedication I'd ever read."
I made a face. Coming from him, that might not have been a compliment. "Nicest."
"Fine, January," he said in a low voice. "I thought it was beautiful. Is that what you want me to admit?"
Again, my heart buoyed through my chest. "Yes."
"I thought it was beautiful,"
he said immediately, sincerely. I turned my face to the window. "Yeah, well, it turned out to be a lie. But I guess Mom thought it was a nice enough one. She knew he was cheating on her and she stayed with him."
"I'm sorry."
For several minutes, neither of us spoke. Finally, Gus cleared his throat. He made it sound so natural.
"You asked why New Eden, why I wanted to write about it."
I nodded, glad for the topic change, though surprised by his segue.
"I guess."
He tugged at his hair anxiously.
"Well, my mom died when I was a kid. Don't know if you knew that."
I wasn't sure how I would have, but even if I didn't outright know it, it fit with the image of him I'd had in college. "I don't think so."
"Yeah," he said. "So my dad was garbage, but my mom, she was amazing. And when I was a kid, I just thought, like, okay, it's us against the world. We're stuck in this situation, but it's not forever. And I kept waiting for her to leave him. I mean, I kept a bag packed with a bunch of comic books and some socks and granola bars. I had this vision of us hopping on a train, riding to the end of the line, you know?"
When his eyes flashed toward me, the corner of his mouth was curled, but the smile wasn't real. It said, "Isn't that ridiculous? Wasn't I ridiculous?" And I knew how to read it because it was a smile I had been practicing for a year. "Can you believe I was so stupid? Don't worry, I know better now." A weight pressed low in my stomach at the image. Gus, before he was the Gus I knew, a Gus who daydreamed about escape, who believed someone would rescue him. "Where were you going to go?" I asked. It came out as little more than a whisper. His eyes leapt back to the road, and the muscle in his jaw pulsed, then relaxed, his face serene once more.
"The Redwoods," he said. "Pretty sure I thought we could build a treehouse there."
"A treehouse in the Redwoods," I repeated quietly, like it was a prayer, a secret. In a way, it was. It was a tiny piece of a Gus I'd never imagined, one with romantic notions and hope for the unlikely. "But what does that have to do with New Eden?" He coughed, checked his rearview mirror, went back to staring down the road.
"I guess a few years ago, I just sort of realized my mom wasn't a kid. He shrugged. I thought we were waiting for the perfect time to leave, but she was never going to. She'd never said she was. She could have taken us out of there, and she didn't.
I shook my head. I doubt it was that simple.
That's why, he murmured. I know it wasn't simple, and when I talk about this book, I tell people it's because I want to explore the reasons people stay, no matter the cost. But the truth is, I just want to understand her reasons. I know that doesn't make sense. This cult thing has nothing to do with her.
No matter the cost. What had staying cost his mother? What had it cost Gus? The weight in my stomach had spread, was pressing against the insides of my chest and palms. I'd started publishing romance because I wanted to dwell in my happiest moments, in the safe place my parents' love had always been. I'd been so comforted by books with the promise of a happy ending, and I'd wanted to give someone else that same gift. Gus was writing to try to understand something horrible that had happened to him. No wonder what we wrote was so different. It does make sense, I said finally. No one gets looking for post-mortem parental answers like I do. If I watched the movie 300 right now, I'd probably find a way to make it about my dad. He gave me a faint smile.
Great cinema.
It was so obviously a thank you and a let's move on now. As different as I'd thought we were, it felt a little bit like Gus and I were two aliens who'd stumbled into each other on Earth, only to discover we shared a native language. We should have a film club, I said. We're always on the same page about this stuff. He was quiet for a moment, thoughtful.
It really was a beautiful dedication, he said. It didn't feel like a lie. Maybe a complicated truth, but not a lie.
The warmth filled me up until I felt like a tea kettle trying hard not to whistle. When I got home, I turned on my computer and ordered my own copy of The Revelatories. And here came the true montage. I did surgery on the book. I ripped it up and stored the pieces in separate files. Ellie became Eleanor. She went from being a down-on-her-luck real estate agent to a down-on-her-luck tightrope walker with a port wine stain the shape of a butterfly on her cheek because absurdly specific details. Her father became a sword swallower, her mother a bearded lady. They moved from the 21st century to the early 20th. They were part of a traveling circus. That was their family, a tight-knit group who ended every night smoking hand-rolled cigarettes around a fire. It was the only world she'd ever known. They spent every moment with each other, but somehow told each other very little. There wasn't much time for talking in their line of work. I renamed the file from beach_book.docx to family_secrets.docx. I wanted to know whether you could ever fully know someone. If knowing how they were, how they moved and spoke, and the faces they made, and the things they tried not to look at, amounted to knowing them. Or if knowing things about them, where they'd been born, all the people they'd been, who they'd loved, the worlds they'd come from, added up to anything. I gave them each a secret. That part was the easiest. Eleanor's mother was dying, but she didn't want anyone to know. The clowns, everyone believed to be brothers, were actually lovers. The sword swallower was still mailing checks to a family back in Oklahoma. They became less and less like the people I knew, but somehow their problems and secrets became more personal. I couldn't put my father or mother down on paper. I could never get that right. But these characters carried the truth of the people I'd loved. I was particularly fond of writing a mechanic named Nick. I loved knowing that no one except me would ever recognize the skeleton of Augustus Everett I'd built the character around. Gus and I made a habit of writing at our respective kitchen tables around noon, and most days we took turns holding up notes. They became more and more elaborate. It was obvious that while some were spontaneous, others were planned, written out earlier in the day or even the night before. Whenever inspiration struck. Those written in the moment especially became nonsensical as writing madness took us over. Sometimes I would laugh so hard I'd lose muscle control in my hands and be unable to write any more notes. We'd laugh until we both laid our heads down on our tables. He'd snort into his coffee. I'd nearly choke on mine. It started with platitudes like, "It is better to have loved and lost than to have never loved at all," me, and "The universe seems neither benign nor hostile, merely indifferent," him, but usually ended with things like, "Fuck writing," me, and "Should we just ditch this and become coal miners?" him. Once, he wrote to tell me that life is like a box of chocolates. You really don't know what you're eating, and the chocolate map in the lid is fucking always wrong. I wrote to tell him that if you're a bird, I'm a bird. He let me know that in space, no one can hear you scream, and I wrote back, "Not all who wander are lost." Going through Dad's stuff fell to the back burner, but I didn't mind procrastinating. For the first time in months, I wasn't flinching every time my phone or laptop pinged. I was making progress. Of course, a lot of that progress was research, but for every new factoid I gleaned about 20th century circus culture, it seemed like a new plot light bulb illuminated over my head. At night, Gus and I sat on our separate decks, having a drink and watching the sun slide into the lake. Most nights we'd talk from across the gap, mostly about how productive we had or hadn't been, about the people we could see from our decks and the stories we could imagine for them. We'd talk about the books and movies we'd loved and hated, the people we'd gone to school with, both together at U of M and before that, Sarah Tulane, who used to pull my hair in kindergarten, Mariah Shogren, who broke up with 16-year-old Gus, a full 3 months into their relationship, he was way too proud to tell me, because he smoked a cigarette in the car with her and kissing a smoker is like licking an ashtray. We talked about our terrible jobs, my part-time car wash position in high school, where I regularly got sexually harassed by customers and had to scrub down the tunnel before I could go home at night, his call center job at a uniform manufacturer, where he got yelled at for incorrect embroideries and delayed shipments. We talked about the most embarrassing albums we'd owned and concerts we'd been to, redacted for the sake of dignity. And other times, we'd sit in silence, not quite together, but definitely not alone. "So what do you think?" I asked him one night. "Are romance and happiness harder than they look?" After a moment, he said,
"I never said that they were easy."
"You implied it," I pointed out.
"I implied they were easy for you," he said. "For me, they're about as challenging as I'm sure you're imagining."
The possibility hung in the air. At any time, one of us could have invited the other over, and either of us would have accepted. But neither of us asked, and so things went on as they'd been. On Friday, we left for our research excursion a bit earlier than we had the week prior and headed east, inland. "Who are we meeting this time?" I asked. Gus answered only,
"Dave."
"Ah, yes, Dave. I'm a big fan of his restaurant, Wendy's."
"Believe it or not, different Dave,"
Gus said. He was lost in thought, barely playing along with our usual banter. I waited for him to go on, but he didn't. "Gus?" His gaze flinched toward me, as if he'd forgotten I was there and my presence had startled him. He scratched at his jaw. His usual 5 o'clock shadow had stretched closer toward a 7 o'clock dusk. "Everything okay?" I asked. His eyes bounced between me and the road 3 times before he nodded. I could almost see it, him swallowing down whatever he'd been considering saying.
"Dave was part of New Eden," he said instead. "He was just a kid back then. His mother took him out of there a few months before the fire. His dad stayed behind. He was in too deep."
"So his father," Gus nodded,
"died in the fire."
We were meeting Dave at an Olive Garden, and on the way in, Gus warned me that Dave was a recovering alcoholic.
3 years sober, Gus said as we waited at the host stand. I told him we wouldn't be drinking anything.
We'd beaten Dave to the table and put in an order for a couple of sodas.
We'd had no problem talking in the car, but sitting across from each other in an Olive Garden booth was a different story.
"Do you feel like your mom just dropped us off here before homecoming?" I asked.
"I never went to homecoming," he said.
I pretended to play a violin, at which point I realized I had no idea how a person actually held a violin.
"What's that?"
Gus said flatly.
"What are you doing?"
"I think I'm holding a violin," I answered.
"No," he said. "No, I can safely say you are not."
"Seriously?"
"Yes, seriously. Why is your left arm straight out like that? Is the violin supposed to balance atop it? You need that hand on the neck."
"You're just trying to distract me from the tragedy of your missed homecoming." He laughed, rolled his eyes, scooted forward on his bench.
"Somehow I survived, tender human heart intact," he said, repeating my words from the carnival.
Now I rolled my eyes. Gus smiled and bumped my knee with his under the table. I bumped his back. We sat there for a minute, grinning at each other over a basket of Olive Garden breadsticks. I felt a little bit like there was water boiling in my chest. At once, I could feel his calloused hands gathering my hair off my neck as I puked into a carnival trash can. I could feel them on my hips and waist, pressing me closer as we danced in the sweaty frat house basement. I could feel the side of his jaw scrape my temple. He broke eye contact first, checked his phone.
20 minutes late, he said without looking at me. I'll give him 10 more before I call.
But Dave didn't answer Gus's call, and he didn't answer Gus's texts or his voicemail, and soon we were an hour and 20 minutes into the bottomless breadsticks, and our server, Vanessa, had started seriously avoiding our table.
"Sometimes this happens," Gus said. "They get spooked, change their minds, think they're ready to talk about something when they're really not."
"What do we do?" I asked. "Should we keep waiting?" Gus opened one of the menus on the table. He flipped through it for a minute, then pointed to a picture of a frozen blue drink with a pink umbrella sprouting out of it.
"That," he said. "I think that's what we do."
"Well, shit," I said. "If we drink our frozen blue things now, then I'll have to totally rethink my plan for tomorrow night."
Gus lifted an eyebrow. "Wow, I was living the lifestyle of a romance writer all along and I didn't even know it.
See? You were born for this, Augustus Everett."
He shuddered.
"Why do you do that?"
"What?" he said.
I repeated, "Augustus Everett." His shoulders lifted, although a bit more discreetly this time. "That."
Gus raised the menu as Vanessa was trying to bound past, and she screeched to a stop like Wile E. Coyote at the edge of a cliff.
"Could we get two of these blue things?" he asked.
His eyes were doing the sexy, intimidating X-ray thing. Color rushed into her cheeks. Or maybe I was projecting what was happening to me onto her.
"Sure thing."
She sped away, and Gus looked back at the menu.
"Augustus," I said.
"Shit,"
he said, flinching again.
"You really don't like sharing things about yourself with other people, do you?"
"Not particularly," he said. "You already know about the vomit phobia. Anything more than that and you'll have to sign a non-disclosure."
"Happily," I said.
Gus sighed and leaned forward, forearms resting on the table. His knee grazed mine beneath the table, but neither of us moved away, and all the heat in my body seemed to focus there.
"The only person who called me that was my father."
He shrugged.
"That name was usually said with a disapproving tone, or screamed in a rage."
My stomach twisted, and a sour taste crept across the back of my mouth as I grasped for something to say. I couldn't help searching his pupils for signs of the history he'd been piecing together for days. His mother had stayed with his father, no matter the cost, and part of that had been her son learning to hate his own name. Gus's gaze lifted from the menu. He looked calm, serious, but it was a practiced look, unlike the alluring openness that sometimes overtook his face when he was deep in thought, working to understand some new information.
"I'm sorry," I said helplessly, "that your dad was an asshole."
Gus gave a breathless laugh,
Why do people always say that? You don't need to be sorry. It's in the past. I didn't tell you so you'd be sorry.
Well, you told me because I asked, so at least let me be sorry for that.
He shrugged. It's fine.
Gus, I said. He looked me in the eye again. It felt like a warm tide rushing over me, feet to head. His expression had shifted to open curiosity.
What were you like? He said.
What?
You know enough about my childhood. I want to know about baby January.
Oh, God, I said. She was a lot. His laugh vibrated through the table, and my insides started fizzing like champagne.
Let me guess. Loud, precocious, room full of books organized in a way that only you understood. Close with your family and a couple of tight-knit friends, all of whom you probably still talk to regularly, but casual friends with anyone else with a pulse. A secret overachiever who had to be the best at something even if no one else knew. Oh, and prone to juggling or tap dancing for attention in any crowd.
Wow, I said, a little stunned. You both nailed and roasted me. Though the tap lessons were my mom's idea. I just wanted the shoes. Anyway, you missed that I briefly had a shrine to Sinead O'Connor because I thought it made me seem interesting. He laughed and shook his head.
I bet you were an adorable little freak.
I was a freak, I said. I think being an only child did that. My parents treated me like a living TV, like I was just this hilarious, interesting baby genius. I seriously spent most of my life delusively confident in myself and my future. And that no matter what else, home would always be a safe place where all three of us belonged. A burning sensation flared in my chest. When I looked up and met Gus's eyes, I remembered where I was, who I was talking to, and half expected him to gloat. The bright-eyed ingenue with all the happy endings had finally gotten chewed up, the rose-colored glasses ground to dust. Instead, he said,
"There are worse things to be than delusively confident."
I studied his dark, focused eyes and lax, crooked mouth, a look of complete sincerity. I was more convinced than ever that I wasn't the only one who'd changed since college, and I wasn't sure what to say to this new Gus Everett. At some point, the frozen blue cocktails had appeared on the table as if by magic. I cleared my throat and lifted my glass. To Dave.
To Dave, Gus agreed, clinking his plastic cup to mine.
The greatest disappointment of this evening by far, I said, is that they didn't actually include the paper umbrellas.
See? Gus said. It's shit like this that makes it impossible for me to believe in happy endings. You never get the paper umbrellas you were promised in this world.
Gus, I said, you must be the paper umbrellas you wish to see in this world.
Gandhi was a wise man.
Actually, I was quoting my favorite poet, Jewel. His knee pressed into mine, and heat pooled between my legs. I pressed back. His rough fingertips tentatively touched my knee, slid up until he found my hand. Slowly, I turned my palm up to him, and his thumb drew heavy circles on it for a minute. When I slid it closer, he folded his fingers into mine, and we sat there, holding hands under the table, pretending we weren't. Pretending we weren't acting 16 years old and a little bit obsessed with each other. God, what was happening? What was I doing, and why couldn't I make myself stop? What was he doing? When the check came, Gus jerked back from me and pulled his wallet out.
I got it,
he said, without looking at me. Chapter 13. The Dream. I dreamed about Gus Everett and woke up needing a shower. Chapter 14. The Rule. I'd had Saturday planned for 3 days, which freed me up to spend the morning working on the book. It was slow going, not because I didn't have ideas, but because it required such painstaking research to confirm that each scene was historically possible. I'd started working at 8 and had managed to write about 500 words by the time Gus came to sit at his kitchen table, facing mine. He wrote his first note of the day and held it up. I squinted to read.
Sorry I got weird last night. My notebook and marker were already ready. They always were. I didn't know exactly what he meant, but I imagined it had something to do with being adults who weren't dating but were holding hands under a table at Olive Garden. I fought a sinking feeling in my stomach. Yes, it had been weird. I had also loved it. From watching Shoddy's love life, I knew how relationship phobes like Gus Everett reacted when boundaries broke down, when things went from friendly to intimate, or from sexual to romantic. Guys like Gus were never the ones to pump the brakes when the emotional entanglement train started moving, and they were always the ones to jump out and roll clear of the tracks once they realized they'd reached top speed. I needed to keep my head straight and eyes clear. No romanticizing allowed. As soon as things got complicated, Gus would be gone, and in this moment, I was realizing how not ready for that I was. He was my only friend here. I had to protect that. Besides, there was the bet, which I couldn't fully benefit from if he ghosted me before I even won. I wrote back, "Don't be ridiculous, Gus. You were always weird." The corner of his mouth twitched into a smile. He held my gaze for a beat too long, then turned his focus back to the notebook. When he held it up next, it showcased a series of numbers. I recognized the first three as the local area code. My stomach flipped. I scribbled the numbers down small at the top of the page, then wrote my own phone number much larger beneath it, followed by, "I'm still going to write these notes." Gus replied, "Good." I wrote another 500 words by 3:30 in the afternoon, at which point I drove over to Goodwill to drop off the load of boxes I'd filled from the upstairs guest room and bath. When I got back, I scrubbed the upstairs bathroom clean, then padded back downstairs to shower in the bathroom I'd been using for the past 2 weeks. The picture of my dad and Sonia still hung on the wall, photo facing inward. I'd felt too guilty to destroy it, but I figured it was only a matter of time until I worked up the courage. For now, it was a bleak reminder that the hardest work was still ahead of me. The basement I hadn't even peeked into, and the master bedroom I'd thoroughly avoided. I still hadn't really been down to the beach, which seemed like a shame. So after I'd made a pot of macaroni to tide me over until tonight, I picked my way down the wooded trail to the water. The light bouncing over the waves from the setting sun was incredible, all reds and golds blazing over the lake's back. I slipped out of my shoes and carried them to the edge of the water, gasping out a swear as the icy tide rushed over my feet. I scrambled back, laughing breathlessly from the sheer shock of it. The air was warm, but not even close to hot enough to make the chill pleasant. Most of the people left on the beach had pulled sweatshirts on or wrapped themselves in towels and blankets. Everyone, all those wind-beaten and sunburned faces, all that lake-tangled hair, those eyes squinting into the fierce light, looking at the same setting sun. It made me ache. I felt suddenly more alone than ever. There was no floppy-haired, romantic Jacques waiting for me in Queens, no one to cook me a real meal or whisk me away from the computer, no missed calls or was just thinking about Karen and Sharon and almost peed again texts from Mom, and no way for me to send her a picture of the sunlight dripping onto the lake without opening the wound that was the lake house. I'd only seen Shoddy twice since the funeral, and with her work schedule, most texts from her came in long after I'd gone to bed, and most of my replies went out long before she'd wake up. My writer friends had stopped checking in too, as if sensing that every note from them, every call and text was just one more reminder of how terribly far behind I had fallen, was falling. Every moment of every day, I was tripping backward while the rest of the world marched forward. Honestly, I even missed Sharon and Karen, sitting on their colorful rag rug drinking the nasty-ass bathtub moonshine they were so proud of while they hawked homemade essential oils that smelled great, even if they didn't actually cure cancer. My world felt empty, like there was no one in it except sometimes Gus, and nothing in it except this book and the bet.
And no matter how much better this book felt than every iteration of it that had come in the last 12 months, it wasn't enough. I was on a beautiful beach, in a beautiful place, and I was alone. Worse, I wasn't sure I'd ever stop being alone again. I wanted my mom, and I missed my lying dad. I sat down in the sand, folded my legs to my chest, rested my forehead against my knees, and cried. I cried until my face was hot and red and soaking wet, and I would have kept crying if a seagull didn't shit on my head, but of course it did. And so I stood and turned back to the path, only to find someone frozen in the middle of it, watching me ugly cry like Tom Hanks in Castaway. It was like something out of a movie, the way Gus was standing there, except that there was nothing romantic or magical about it. Even though I'd been sobbing about being alone, he was one of the last people I would have chosen to see me like this. Momentarily forgetting the pile of bird excrement on my head, I wiped at my face and eyes, trying to make myself look more something. "Sorry," Gus said, visibly uncomfortable. He glanced sidelong down the beach. "I saw you come down here, and I just..."
"A bird pooped on my head," I said tearily.
Apparently, there was nothing more to say than that. His look of painful empathy cracked under a soundless laugh. He closed the gap between us and pulled me roughly into a hug. The action seemed uncomfortable, if not painful, for him at first, but even so, it was something of a relief to be held.
"You don't have to tell me," he said. "But just so you know, you can."
I buried my face in his shoulder, and his hands clumsy padding against my back settled into slow, gentle circles before they stopped moving at all, just curled in against my spine, easing me closer. I let myself sink into him. The crying had stopped as fast as it had started. All I could think about was the press of his hard stomach and chest, the sharp ridges of his hips, and the almost smoky smell of him, the heat of his body and his breath. It was a bad idea to stand here like this with him, touch him like this, but it was also intoxicating. I decided to count to three and then let go. I got to two before his hand slid into my hair, cradling the back of my head, and then jerked suddenly clear as he took an abrupt step back.
"Wow, that's a lot of shit."
He was staring at his hand and the goop dripping off of it.
"Yeah, I said bird, but it very well could have been a dinosaur."
"No kidding. I guess we should get cleaned up before we take off for the night."
I sniffed and wiped the residual tears away from my eyes. Was "take off" an intentional bird pun, or?
"Hell no," Gus said,
turning back toward the trail with me.
"I said that because I assumed we would be taking a helicopter ride over the lake."
A ripple of timid laughter went through me, breaking up the residual knot of emotion and heat in my chest. "Is that your final guess?" He looked me up and down, as if weighing my outfit against some widely recognized helicopter date uniform.
"Yeah, I think so."
So close.
"Really?"
he said.
"What is it then? Tiny airplane over the lake? Tiny submarine under the lake?"
"You'll have to wait and find out." We parted ways between our houses, agreeing to meet at my car in 20 minutes. When I'd washed my hair for the second time that day, I threw it into a bun and put the same poop-free outfit back on. I'd packed most of the supplies for our trip earlier that day, so all I had left to do was grab the rest out of the fridge and stuff it into the cooler I'd found on one of the kitchen's bottom shelves. It was 7:30 when Gus and I finally set out, and 8:40 when we finally pulled in to Meg Ryan night at Big Boy Bobby's Drive-In.
"Oh my God,"
Gus said as we drove up to the booth to hand over the tickets I'd bought online.
"This is a triple feature."
He was reading the glowing marquee to our right, "When Harry Met Sally," "Sleepless in Seattle," and "You've Got Mail."
"Aren't half of those Christmas movies?"
The attendant raised the gate, and I pulled through. Half of three is one and a half, so no, half of these movies aren't Christmas movies.
"Have I mentioned that Meg Ryan's face pisses me off?"
I scoffed,
One, no. Two, that's impossible. Her face is adorable and perfect.
Maybe that's what it is, Gus said. I couldn't tell you, and I know it's not logical, but I just can't stand her.
Tonight, that's all going to change, I promised. Trust me, you just have to open your heart. If you can do that, your world's going to be a much brighter place from now on. And maybe you'll even stand a chance at writing a sellable rom-com.
January, he said solemnly as I backed into an open parking spot. Just imagine what you'd do to me if I took you to a 6-hour-long Jonathan Franzen reading.
I cannot and I will not, I said. And if you choose to use one of our Friday nights in such a way, there's nothing I can do to stop you, but it's Saturday, and thus I'm the captain of this ship. Now come help me figure out where we can buy the Big Bobby ice cream surprise I read about online. According to the website, it is so worth it.
It had better be.
Gus sighed, climbing out of the Kia to join me. As the previews flashed clunkily across the screen, we made our way through the field to the concession stands. I beelined for the wooden sign painted to look like an ice cream sundae, but Gus touched my arm, stopping me from getting in line right away.
Will you just promise me one thing?
Gus, I won't fall in love with you.
One more thing, he said. Please just try your hardest not to puke.
If I start to, I'll just swallow it. Gus cupped his hand over his mouth and gagged. Kidding! I won't puke. At least not until you take me to that 6-hour reading. Now, come on. I've spent all week looking forward to eating something other than cold Pop-Tarts.
I don't think this is going to be the vitamin and nutrient-rich smorgasbord you seem to be imagining.
I don't need vitamins. I need nacho cheese and chocolate sauce.
Ah, in that case, you planned the perfect night.
Because I'd bought the tickets, Gus paid for the popcorn and the ice cream surprises. $6 each, decidedly unworth it. And he tried to buy us sodas before I completely, indiscreetly cut him off, doing my best to signal that we had other options in the car. When we got back, I opened the tailgate and put the middle seats flat, revealing the setup of pillows and blankets I'd packed earlier, along with the cooler full of beer.
Impressed? I asked Gus.
By your car's trunk space? Absolutely.
Har, 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 I said.
Har, 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 Gus said back.
We climbed through the open trunk, and I turned the car on, tuning the radio to the right channel to pick up the movie's audio before settling in beside Gus just as the opening credits began. Despite what he'd said about trunk space, the Kia wasn't exactly big. Lying on our stomachs, chins propped up on our hands, we were very nearly touching in several places, and our elbows were touching. This position wouldn't be comfortable for long, and rearranging with both of us in the car was going to be a challenge. Being this close to him was also going to be a challenge. As soon as Meg Ryan appeared on screen, he leaned a little closer and whispered,
"Her face really doesn't bother you."
"I think you should see a doctor," I hissed. "That's not a normal reaction." As soon as I got my first book advance, I'd bought Shoddy and myself both like 20 Meg Ryan movies so we could watch them together long distance whenever we wanted, starting them at the same exact moment so we could text about what was happening in real time and pausing whenever one of us had to pee.
"Just wait until you hear how Meg Ryan pronounces horses when she sings Sleigh Ride," I whispered to Gus. "Your life will be irrevocably changed."
Gus gave me a look like I wasn't helping my case.
"She just looks so damn smug," he said.
"A lot of people have told me I look like her," I said.
"There's no way that's true."
"Okay, they haven't, but they should have."
"That's ridiculous," he said. "You look nothing like her."
On the one hand, I'm offended. On the other, I'm relieved you probably don't loathe my face.
"There's nothing to loathe about your face," he said matter-of-factly.
"There's nothing to loathe about Meg Ryan's face either."
"Fine, I take it back. I love her face. Does that make you happy?"
I turned toward him. His head was propped in his hand, his body angled toward me, and the light from the screen just barely caught his eyes, drawing liquidy slivers of color in them. His dark hair was as messy as ever, but his facial hair was back under control, and that smoky smell still hung on him.
"January," he murmured.
I maneuvered onto my side, facing him, and nodded. It makes me happy. His knee bumped mine. I bumped his back. A shadow of a smile passed over his serious face, there and gone so fast I might have imagined it.
Good,
he said. We stayed like that for a long time, pretending to watch the movie from an angle where neither of us could possibly see more than half the screen, our knees pressed into one another. Whenever one of us rearranged, the other followed. Whenever one of us could no longer bear the discomfort of one position, we both shifted. But we never stopped touching. We were in dangerous territory. I hadn't felt like this in years, that almost painful weight of wanting, that paralyzing fear that any wrong move would ruin everything. I glanced up when I felt his gaze on me, and he didn't look away. I wanted to say something to break the tension, but my mind was mercilessly blank. Not the blinking cursor on a white screen blank of trying to concoct a novel from thin air. The color popping in darkness blank of scrunching your eyes shut, of staring at flames too long. The pulsing blank of feeling so much you're incapable of thinking anything. The staring contest stretched an uncomfortable distance without either of us breaking it. His eyes looked nearly black, and when the light from the screen hit them, the illusion of flames sparked in them, then vanished. Somewhere deep in my mind, a self-preservation instinct was screaming, "Those are the eyes of a predator!" But that was exactly why nature gave predators eyes like that, so dumb little rabbits like me wouldn't stand a chance. Don't be a dumb bunny, January. I have to go to the bathroom, I said abruptly. Gus smiled.
You just went to the bathroom.
I have a really tiny bladder, I said.
I'll go with you.
That's okay, I chirped, and forgetting I was in a car, sat up so fast I slammed my head into the roof.
Shit,
Gus said, at the same time I hissed out a confused, what? He bolted up and shuffled on his knees toward where I sat, clutching my head.
Let me see.
His hands cradled the sides of my face, tilting my head down so he could see the crown of my skull.
It's not bleeding, he told me,
then angled my face back up into his fingers threaded gently through my hair. His eyes wandered down to my mouth, and his crooked lips parted.
Oh, damn. I was a bunny.
I leaned toward him, and his hands went to my waist, drawing me onto his lap so that I was straddling him where he knelt. His nose brushed the side of mine, and I lifted my mouth under his, trying to close the gap between us. Our slow breaths pressed us into each other, and his hands squeezed my sides, my thighs tightening against him in reaction. One time, one time, one time was all I could think. That was his policy, right? Would it really be so bad if something happened between us just once? We could go back to being friends, neighbors who talked every day. Could I do casual this one time with my college crush turned nemesis 7 years after the fact? I couldn't think clearly enough to figure it out. My breathing was shaky and shallow. His was non-existent. We hovered there for a minute, like neither of us wanted to accept the blame. You touched me first, I'd say. You leaned in, he'd fire back. And then you scooped me into your lap, and you lifted your mouth toward mine. And then his mouth dragged warm breath across my jaw and then up to my lips. His teeth skated across my bottom lip, and a small hum of pleasure went through me. His mouth quirked into a smile even as it sank hot and light against my mouth, coaxing it open. He tasted like vanilla and cinnamon left over from the ice cream surprise, only better than the dessert itself had. His heat rushed into my mouth, into me, until it was flooding through me, racing like a river current baked hot by the sun. Want dripped through me, pooling in all the nooks that formed between our bodies. I reached for a handful of his shirt, feeling the warmth of his skin through the thin material. I needed him closer, to remember how it felt to be pressed against him, to be wrapped around him. One of his hands swept up the side of my neck, his fingers curling under my hair. I sighed into his mouth as he kissed me again, slower, deeper, rougher. He tipped my mouth up to him for more, and I grabbed for his ribs, trying to get closer. He leaned into me until my back met the side of the car, until he pressed hard against me. A stupid gasp escaped me at the feel of his chest unyielding against mine, and I ground my hips against his. He braced one hand on the window behind me, and his teeth caught my bottom lip again, a little harder this time. My breaths came fast and shaky as his hand swiped down the car window to my chest, feeling me through my shirt. I raked my hands through his hair, arched into the press of his hand, and a low, involuntary groan lifted in his throat. He leaned away and flipped me onto my back, and I greedily pulled him over me. A pulse went through me at the feeling of him hard against me, and I tried to will him closer than clothes allowed. That sound rasped out of him again. I couldn't remember the last time I'd been this turned on. Actually, I could. It was 7 years ago in a frat house basement. His hand slipped up beneath my shirt, his thumb scraping up the length of my hip bone and seeming to melt it as he went. His mouth grazed hot and damp down my neck, sinking heavily against my collarbone. My whole body was begging him for more without any subtlety, lifting toward him as if pulled by a magnet. I felt like a teenager, and it was wonderful, and it was horrible, and he tightened over me as light hit us, as cold and sobering as if someone had dumped a bucket of ice water on us. We sprang apart at the sight of the surly, middle-aged woman with the flashlight aimed our way. She had a frizzy triangle of gray hair and a bright blue track jacket screen-printed with the Big Boy Bobby's logo. She cleared her throat. Gus was still propped up over me with one hand tangled in the hem of my shirt.
"This is a family establishment," the woman hissed.
"Well, you're doing a great job."
Gus's voice was thick and husky. He cleared it again and gave the woman his best evil smile.
"My wife and I were just saying we should bring the kids here sometime."
She folded her arms, apparently immune to the charms of his mouth.
"Must be nice."
Gus knelt back onto his heels, and I tugged my shirt down.
"Sorry about that," I said, mortified.
The woman jerked a thumb down the dark, grassy aisle between cars.
"Out," she barked.
"Of course,"
Gus said quickly, and jerked the tailgate closed, shutting us off from her. I burst out in humiliated, deranged laughter, and Gus turned toward me with a faint smile, his lips bruised and swollen, his hair disastrous.
"That was such a bad idea," I whispered helplessly.
"Yeah."
Gus's voice slipped back into its dangerous rasp. He leaned forward through the dark and caught me in one last viciously slow, dementedly hot kiss, his fingers spanning the side of my face.
"Won't happen again,"
he told me, and all the sparks awake in my bloodstream fizzled out just a bit. One time, that was his rule. But did this count? My gut twisted with disappointment. It couldn't. It had done nothing to satisfy me. If anything, it had left me worse off than before, and from the way Gus was staring at me, I thought he must feel the same way. The woman banged on the back window, and we both jumped.
"We should go," Gus said.
I scrambled from the back of the car into the front seat. Gus got out the back door and back into the passenger seat. I drove us home, feeling like my body was a heat map, and everywhere he'd touched, everywhere he looked when he glanced over from the passenger seat, was glowing red. Gus didn't appear at the kitchen table at noon on Sunday. I figured that was a bad sign, that what had happened had destroyed the only friendship I had in this town. Really, one of only several friendships I had the world over, since Jacques and my couple of friends, it had turned out, had no use for just me. I tried to put Gus out of my mind, to work on the book with singular focus, but I went back to jumping every time my phone buzzed. A text from Anya.
"Hey, love, just wanted to check in. The house would really like to see some initial pages to give some input."
An email from Pete.
"Hello, good news. Your books will be in stock tomorrow. Is there a day this week you could stop by to sign?"
An email from Sonia, which I did not open, but whose first sentence I could see.
Please, please don't let me scare you off from book club. I'm totally happy to stay home on Monday nights if you'd like to keep...
A text from Shoddy. January, help. I cannot get enough of that haunted hat. He's come over the last 3 nights, and last night I let him stay.
I texted her back. You know exactly where this is going. You're into him.
I hate falling in love, she replied. It's always ruining my bad boy reputation.
I sent her a sad face. I know, but you must persevere for the good of the haunted hat and so I can live vicariously through you.
Memories from last night flashed across my mind, as bright and hot as fireworks, the sparks landing and burning everywhere he'd touched. I could feel the ghost of his teeth on my collarbone, and my shoulder blade was a little bruised from the car door. Hunger and embarrassment raced through me in one twisted braid. God, what had I done? I should have known better. And then there was the part of me that couldn't stop thinking, am I going to get to do it again? It didn't have to mean anything. Maybe this was it. I would finally learn how to have a casual relationship. Or maybe the deal was off and I would literally never hear from Gus Everett again. I was out of both cereal and ramen, so after I'd painfully churned out 300 words, I decided to break for a grocery trip and, on my way out the door, saw that Gus's car wasn't in its usual spot on the street. I forced the thought from my head. This didn't have to be a big deal. At the grocery store, I checked my bank account again, then wandered the aisles with my phone calculator open, adding up the price of frosted mini wheats and cans of soup. I'd managed to put together a decent haul for $16 when I rounded the corner to the checkout and saw her there. Curly white hair, willowy frame, that same crocheted shawl. Panic coursed through me so fast, I felt like I'd gotten an adrenaline shot in the heart. I abandoned my cart right there in the aisle and, head down, booked it past her toward the doors. If she saw me, she didn't say anything. Or if she did, my heart was pounding too loud for me to hear it. I jumped back into my car, feeling like I'd robbed a bank, and drove 20 minutes to another grocery store where I was so shaken up and paranoid about another run-in that I barely managed to get anything. By the time I got home, I was still shaky, and it didn't help that Gus's car hadn't reappeared. It was one thing to have to dodge Sonia in my bi-monthly grocery trips. If I wound up having to avoid my next-door neighbor, I was pretty sure Plan B move to Duluth would have to take effect. Before I crawled into bed that night, I peeked out the front windows one more time, but Gus's car was still missing. Dread inflated in my chest like the world's least fun balloon. I'd finally found a friend, someone I could talk to, who'd seemed to want to be around me as much as I wanted to be around him, and now he was just gone. Because we'd kissed. Anger reared up in me,